Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Our organization passed the resolution unanimously to support the Willow Project, which is clear that there's majority consensus on the North Slope.
North Slope groups make the case for the Willow Drilling Project as the Biden administration considers approving it. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 14th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaskan scientists are still cut off from Russian colleagues and research is suffering.
We really can't do our work, either of us on either side, without each other.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you an Alaska artist or do you know one? March 1st is the deadline to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. The program provides awards to artists, musicians, performers, writers, and culture bearers. Amounts are increasing. A project award, now $10,000, is available for an Alaska artist at any career stage. Mid-career and established artists may apply for a $25,000 artist fellowship. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. Rasmussen Foundation, promoting a better life for all Alaskans. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaska has joined nearly 24 states in a lawsuit that would eliminate Americans' access to a pill used for abortions, even in states where abortion is legal. The original suit was filed by an anti-abortion medical group. It aims to revoke the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's approval of the abortion pill called mifepristone. Alaska's attorney general signed on last week. Abortion is legal in Alaska, but if successful, the suit could still reduce access to reproductive health care here. The pill is used for about 1/3 of abortions in Alaska, and about 1/3 of Alaska women live in a borough without a clinic that provides abortion services. The pill could be immediately taken off the market if the judge sides with the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs claim the FDA exceeded its authority when it approved the drug 2 decades ago. The defendant's opposition says the lawsuit is extraordinary and unprecedented and could cause significant harm if successful. It argues that the courts should not tell the FDA to remove a safe and effective drug that's been on the market for more than 20 years. The Alaska Attorney General's office wrote in a statement that when the FDA allowed the drug to be available through the mail, it undermined the authority of states where abortion is illegal. A Trump-appointed judge in Texas will decide the case. A ruling could come as soon as the end of the month. Alaska's U.S. senators warned that half measures won't suffice as they campaign to get federal approval for ConocoPhillips' Willow drilling project in the western Arctic. Senator Lisa Murkowski told reporters today that the Biden administration may try to reduce the plan to 2 drill sites to ensure that it won't be economically viable.
So in effect, to be able to have it both ways, the project doesn't proceed, satisfies the environmental community, but they can say, well, we approved it. That is not acceptable. That cannot happen.
ConocoPhillips proposed 5 drill sites west of the community of Nuiqsut is in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The Bureau of Land Management has recommended an option that includes 3 drilling sites, or about 219 wells. But BLM's parent agency, the Interior Department, immediately issued a statement saying that it was not required to approve that preferred alternative. Senator Dan Sullivan interprets that as a signal that Interior wants to curtail the project. The online press conference was arranged by a public relations firm working for Voice of the Arctic Inupiat, a pro-development advocacy group funded by the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and the North Slope Borough. The group's president, Nagarik Harcharek, says the 24-member organizations represent the leadership of the region.
Our organization passed the resolution unanimously to support the Willow Project, which is clear that there's majority consensus on the North Slope.
National environmental groups oppose the project. They say the project would threaten wildlife in the area and that the fuel produced will accelerate climate change. Other opponents include the city and tribe of Nuiqsut. They've written a letter opposing Willow. Harcharek, though, points out that the Village Corporation of Nuiqsut supports the drilling project. American scientists made a startling walrus discovery last fall. They found 200,000 Pacific walrus lounging on one Russian beach bordering the Chukchi Sea. That's a huge number that could indicate there are a lot more walruses in the world than previously thought. But it's been difficult to confirm the number without input from Russian scientists. Once a collaborative partnership, American and Russian researchers have been cut off from each other for almost a year since Russia invaded Ukraine. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
For decades stretching back to the Cold War, Russian and American scientists have been close partners on Pacific walrus research. U.S. and Soviet researchers began flying joint aerial surveys to count the animals in 1975.
Even during my career, almost 30 years, there are people I've worked with the entire time. They've been on ships with us, shoulder to shoulder, working closely together. We gather data together, we publish it together. That's been our tradition. And we really can't do our work, either of us on either side, without each other.
Tony Fishbach is a research biologist for the U.S. Geological Survey, studying walrus populations. In the last year, Fishbach's research has hit roadblocks. Since Russia invaded Ukraine last February, the U.S. imposed sanctions and began to cut off government funding and research relationships with Russian institutions. As a result, Fishbach, a federal employee, hasn't been in touch with his colleagues across the Bering Strait.
We don't want them to be put in any danger for communicating with Americans. And we have, to our sanctions, we also need to step back and not have direct communication.
But walrus don't recognize international borders. And after Fishbach and his American colleagues made an exciting walrus discovery this year, it's been hard to move the research forward without Russian input. Fishbach's team used satellite data to count around 200,000 walrus on one Russian beach bordering the Chukchi Sea. For context, the most recent population count estimated only around 260,000 Pacific walrus in the world. Fishbach says their findings in Russia could mean the total number of walrus is much higher. But he says they won't know for sure until Russian scientists can confirm they're accurately interpreting the satellite data.
Our approach is to continue doing what we can and hope that they can do what they can. We'll publish our findings and our data. They can access that. They can publish their findings and their data, and we can move our science forward.
This new format for scientific progress is like playing a long-distance game of telephone through formally published findings. The strained relationship between Russia and the U.S. has also slowed research at the university level. Vladimir Romanovsky is a Russian-born permafrost scientist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says increased tension with the outside world has made it riskier for Russian scientists to work with foreign agencies or accept funding from outside Russia.
Anybody who getting funds, no matter what kind of funds, from abroad, from the Western countries, you can get this new title, foreign agent, which is very serious in Russia. So you can go to jail even for that.
Universities aren't subject to the same sanctions that federal agencies like USGS are. So Romanovsky can still communicate virtually with his Russian colleagues. But meeting in person has proved difficult as the international scientific community has moved to exclude Russia from conferences in the last year. Romanovsky says while it's still possible to continue ongoing projects with his Russian colleagues, starting any new collaborations will be difficult.
Pretty much like it's hurting, not immediate right now, but the future definitely. There is much more problems with the future.
Romanovsky wants to bring some of his colleagues to Alaska for a research visit in the fall, but he says getting them visas will be nearly impossible. Meanwhile, Fishbach is waiting to see if his Russian colleagues confirm the giant walrus count in their own scientific paper. There's no way to know when the publication is coming, but he says he trusts they're working on it. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, chickpea water is a cookie ingredient? Yeah, cooks are experimenting with egg substitutes.
They look good so far, and when I was mixing, they felt like regular, so I'm really hopeful.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Oil and gas producer Hilcorp applied earlier this month to drill three new natural gas production wells in Nanilchik, citing the discovery of new gas reserves. The announcement comes as the state forecasts a waning supply of available Cook Inlet natural gas. Hilcorp told local utilities last spring that it could not guarantee gas supply beyond existing contracts. Even though Hilcorp is not pursuing major new gas projects in Cook Inlet, it's still producing from existing pads on the southern Kenai Peninsula, which are already connected to infrastructure to extract and deliver supply. The wells Hilcorp plans to drill are on two existing pads in the Nanilchik unit. Production within that unit has increased more than 50% in the last year, according to Petroleum News. It's not uncommon for companies to drill new wells to access existing supply, since wells decline in productivity every few years. Cook Inlet gas fields are also heavily faulted, which means producers need to drill lots of wells to access all the pockets of gas in an area. Hilcorp's application says it plans to drill the wells this spring. It does not say how much gas it expects to produce from these new wells. Juneau's Deputy Director of Public Works, Denise Koch, will represent the city as a new member of the Environmental Protection Agency's Local Government Advisory Committee. The committee, made up of representatives from across the country, aims to gather feedback on the ways environmental issues impact local governments.
This is like a very nerdy, wonky thing to be a part of and to be excited about, but I am excited about being on this committee.
Last year, the passage of the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act and bipartisan infrastructure package made billions of dollars available for things like clean energy and pollution reduction. Much of that funding will be distributed to cities and towns. But Koch says navigating the complicated landscape of federal programs takes time and expertise, which makes it hard for smaller communities like Juneau to compete.
It takes resources to chase resources. And by that, I mean grant writing is its own skill. You have to have a vision for a particular project. You have to know how to compete for it.
She says the committee aims to make climate and environmental action more accessible by connecting local governments to EPA administrators. And her team is already working to secure some of the newly available federal money. The city has applied for a solid waste infrastructure grant that could help to establish a permanent municipal composting facility. And another pending grant would help to fortify Juneau's wastewater processing. Koch says that's just the beginning. More federal grant opportunities will be rolled out in the coming months, including many grants to bolster climate action. Koch hopes to help Juneau secure that funding. Koch also said she hopes her role on the committee will help the EPA to better understand the needs of small communities when tightening federal pollution standards. The Defense Department has awarded a $12.5 million contract to a Georgia-based company to cover the cost of maintaining and repairing the fuel systems of Alaska's biggest military airfields. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The contract awarded last month is part of a four-year, $45 million deal to maintain systems that provide aviation fuel at 10 airfields in Alaska and 11 in Hawaii. The Alaskan installations include Fort Wainwright, Eielson Air Force Base, Fort Greeley, Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, and Erickson Air Station on Amchitka out in the Aleutians.
These airfields have pipes and valves associated with their fueling systems that need recurring maintenance.
Scott Farrow is a spokesperson for the Army Engineering and Support Center in Huntsville, Alabama, an agency under the Army Corps of Engineers. Farrow says the work paid for through the contract is being done in support of the Defense Logistics Agency's Energy Division mission to keep the fuel flowing to aircraft at U.S. military airfields.
Systems, they age. So what we do is ensure through our contract and our subcontractors that these vital systems are maintained throughout the bases in Alaska.
Farrow says the contractor, Georgia-based Pawn Constructors, usually subcontracts with in-state companies to do much of the work. He says the fuel systems projects at Wainwright, Greeley, Eielson, and Jaybear cost about $500,000 annually for each installation. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
A tribe's push to open federal subsistence hunts and fisheries to Ketchikan residents took a big step last week. The Federal Subsistence Board approved a closer look at Ketchikan Indian Community's proposal to redesignate Ketchikan as a rural area under federal rules. If the change goes through, it would greatly expand the ways Ketchikan residents can hunt and fish. The tribe says it's one piece of a fight for an inherent right that's been going on for hundreds of years. But as KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, not everyone is thrilled.
It all hinges on one key question. Is Ketchikan a rural community? The Federal Subsistence Board voted unanimously earlier this month to conduct a formal study of the question. That means that the board agreed that Ketchikan met four basic guidelines to be considered for a rural designation, namely that there's information to support the request and that the community has changed in the years since it was designated as non-rural. Now the board can take a closer look at the proposal's merit. Anthony Christensen is the board chair.
Oh, they'll just continue to look at the characteristics, you know, of rural and, you know, access to alternative resources, you know, transportation. There's a bunch of criteria, you know, characteristics of and uses of the surrounding resources, things like that. So they look, you know, more closely at the community itself.
Christensen says he doesn't know what the board will decide, but pointed to Saxman, a smaller community on Ketchikan's road system. The town of about 400 was redesignated as rural in 2016.
When they went through it with Saxman, you know, obviously Saxman got its rural status, and it's a similar in nature, even though, you know, they were able to distinct their community as a different community. Still, the majority of the characteristics are similar in nature, but based off of that's what they'll be looking for, is if they meet a similar criteria like as Saxman did when they went through their process.
Trixie Bennett, the Ketchikan Indian Community's past president and a tribal council member, was one of a handful of tribe representatives who testified at the meeting. She says this is a hopeful step forward.
My great-great-great-grandfather was fighting for hunting and fishing rights way back in 1890. Right after the Organic Act took away rights to our land and access to the land. And here we are 130 years later, finally making some progress for the people of Ketchikan, for the native people of Ketchikan.
Bennett says much of the work has involved the state's Department of Fish and Game, the Department of the Interior, and the Office of Subsistence Management. But despite a sense of hope among many in Ketchikan, others worry the change will open up new problems when it comes to resource management. On nearby Prince of Wales Island, at least one key subsistence resource is already stressed. Clinton Cook is the president of the Craig Tribal Association, the tribe based in Prince of Wales Island's largest community.
When you start allowing cities rural status, it will take resources from members in our communities that have rural status.
For years, residents have worried over declining deer populations. Cook says that more hunters coming to the island would mean less chances for locals to fill their freezers. Hunters from rural communities get to start deer season a month early in July. Rural hunters also can hunt in more areas than non-rural hunters.
You're inviting 2,000 to 3,000 more people to come and take a resource that's already strained.
Cook also mentioned Saxman's rural status. But he says Saxman and Ketchikan are different places despite the fact that they're connected to the same road system on the same island.
It took Saxman many years, many attempts to become rural. Saxman is a different community than Ketchikan.
Cook says his tribe will be drafting a resolution against a rural designation for Ketchikan. He says he's working to rally opposition from tribes across the island.
If Ketchikan becomes rural, who says Juneau can't apply it to be rural status and or Anchorage? And then the whole state might as well be considered a rural area.
It's not clear how widespread opposition is on Prince of Wales Island. Federally recognized tribes in Heidelberg, Klawak, and Kasan did not return requests for comment on the proposal. And as it happens, Christensen, the Federal Subsistence Board chair who voted to advance the proposal, is the mayor of the city of Heidelberg. Cook says that Ketchikan's tribe should have come to the island and met with local tribes before pushing for the redesignation. Bennett from Ketchikan's tribe says there was some outreach, but not enough.
So
But we know we need to reach out to the tribes over there on Prince of Wales, and we're looking forward to that work.
She says it's a priority going forward, and Cassian and Heidelberg have already invited Ketchikan's tribe to visit. Bennett says the groups will be looking into ways to protect local hunters on Prince of Wales Island. She pointed to regulations that could prohibit Ketchikan hunters from harvesting on the island if the population got too low. A final decision on Ketchikan's status isn't expected until 2025. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska. Alaska Pacific University offers degree programs with life-friendly, flexible scheduling and course delivery options grounded in real-life experience. Alaska Pacific University offers innovative programming in nursing, counseling, psychology, outdoor and environmental public health, and more. Financial aid is available. Advance your career with APU today. Learn more and apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The U.S. team headed to the World Cross-Country Ski Championships in Slovenia includes several athletes with Alaska connections. On the 10-person men's squad are David Norris, who grew up skiing in Fairbanks, and Anchorage skiers Luke Jaeger, Scott Patterson, Gus Schumacher, and Hunter Wonders. On the women's side, fourth-ranked World Cup skier Rosie Brennan and fellow Anchorage-based skier Haley Swirble are part of a group of eight headed to the championships, which are happening in Planica, Slovenia, February 23rd through March 5th. Well, eggs are finally trickling back into stores across the nation, but for weeks, bakers faced a tough problem. How do you bake without eggs? One Dillingham baker rose to the challenge just in time for Valentine's Day. KDLG's Izzy Ross visited her kitchen and has this report.
On a frosty morning in mid-January, Kirsten Ariano is working in her kitchen on the outskirts of Dillingham.
Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
I've got 2 3-year-olds in there, but they're watching a cartoon, and I told them that we're going to be talking, so they're just going to hang out in there.
Okay. Wow, it smells amazing in here.
Oh, good.
About 3 dozen perfectly round, bright blue blobs rest on a baking sheet.
Got some vegan macaron shells here. They look good so far. They look, and when I was mixing, they felt like regular. So I'm really hopeful.
Ariano bakes from her home for Bristol Baking, a business she started last year. Along with signature and custom cakes, Ariano experiments with local ingredients like cranberries, salmon berries, and fireweed. But the number one ingredient in her best-selling pastry? Eggs.
I mostly make macarons. They're for sure my most popular and my favorite thing to make.
Macarons are small French desserts made of 2 delicate meringue shells that sandwich a filling of jam, ganache, or cream. The shells are normally made by whipping together egg whites, almond flour, powdered and granulated sugar, and piping the batter into rounds on a tray. But Ariano hasn't been able to buy as many eggs as usual this year. So she's had to get creative, rising to the challenge of baking during a national egg shortage, just in time for Valentine's Day.
Okay, so these are bright blue. So talk to me a little bit about like that, the recipe.
Yeah, so macarons actually don't have a lot in them. It's powdered sugar, granulated sugar, almond flour, and egg white. I use gel food color, but these are the vegan shells that I'm trying out. They have aquafaba instead of egg white.
Aquafaba is chickpea water. You can get it from a can of chickpeas at the grocery store. And it's a great egg white substitute. Like many others, Ariano began baking after the COVID-19 pandemic started 3 years ago. And in rural Alaska, that takes some innovation. She says the egg shortage has pushed her to try new recipes and better understand how eggs are used in baking and what makes a good substitute.
The egg might provide moisture. In which case you can substitute with something like yogurt or applesauce to get that moisture. That's one thing, you get to be a little more resourceful baking in the bush, because what can you do? So that's my timer. These macarons go in at 9 minutes, and then they have to be rotated. You can hear the hollow. when I tap the shell?
When they first come out of the oven, before they have any filling, they're hollow. And so when you fill them, the moisture allows the shell to expand inside and get soft. So if I bit into this right now, it'd be really crunchy. But if I fill it with something soft and let it sit for 24 hours in the fridge, it'll be nice and soft.
The chickpea water works. When the first batch comes out of the oven, they've swelled a bit, but none have erupted, each still perfectly round, like rows of blueberry emojis. And the final product is delicious. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Hey, did you hear? Valentine's Day is today. And that means there's typically a surge in demand for flowers. KMXT's Brian Venois talked to a local florist in Kodiak about how she prepares for the holiday and has this story.
Belma Lorente is the owner of Belma's Precious Flowers and Gifts in Kodiak. It's a small shop with a few displays and a section in the back bursting with blooms. She got her start learning how to arrange and order flowers from the island Safeway, but started her own business nearly 20 years ago.
Honestly, when I work at Safeway, I don't see any competition for Safeway. Only Safeway is the florist, and I said, oh.
Lorente says she didn't just want to compete with the grocery giant. She also wanted to give folks a bigger variety of flowers to choose from.
I think it's nice that there's another choices for customers at the island also, you know. Just like they could go here, they could go there. Like they have a choices for their own design also.
But as one might expect, it can be difficult to source flowers in Alaska, especially in the winter. So Lorente works with other florists from across North America to ensure she has a fresh and varied stock. She generally places orders up to 3 months in advance to prepare for big holidays like Valentine's Day.
I have three different companies. This one I have from Florida, and I have some from around in Canada, that one, and I have one in Anchorage.
Business has been good for Lorente. She sold out on Valentine's Day last year, and between pre-orders and last-minute customers, she expects to sell out again this year. She's even had clientele from New York, California, and Texas order through her website. But Lorente credits most of her success to local support.
I love the island also. Like, they support me. There's a lot of, like, those native corporations, other businesses, local, they support me. So I'm still here for 20 years.
As for Lorente's favorite flowers, she likes stargazers, lilies, and roses. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venois.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Claire Strempel and Anna Canny in Juneau, Kavitha George and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Riley Board in Kenai, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, and Brian Venois in Kodiak. If you want to send us a news tip, question, comment, Valentine, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Fight produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Happy Valentine's Day.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.